Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. This is the show that brings you Christian and non-Christian discussion every week, but doing things a little bit differently today. And if you're not familiar with the show and you'd like to listen back to past episodes, can I encourage you to go to our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You'll find loads of past episodes of the show, many interesting discussions and debates on all kinds of topics there. Unbelievable brought to you in association with Premier Christianity magazine and as part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio. And of course, if you go to our website, you'll find details of this year's Unbelievable Conference 2017 happening on Saturday, the 13th of May. And I'm very excited to say that my main guest on today's show is our keynote speaker for the conference. He is John Lennox. We're going to be meeting him and asking him all kinds of questions on today's program. Still to come, though, after Unbelievable today, you're going to be hearing The Profile, and you'll be hearing another Christian talk about their walk of life and faith. And don't forget that towards the end of today's show, you'll be hearing some of the feedback you've sent in recent weeks. Loads of interesting shows we've had recently, some philosophical debates, especially divine hiddenness a couple of weeks ago. And last week's one was an interesting one, a Hindu and Christian sitting down to talk. So we'll be hearing what you had to say about some of the recent editions of the show. But you've been sending in your feedback for my guest today. It's Professor John Lennox. Let me tell you what we're doing on today's show.
You're unbelievable.
Well, we're doing an Ask John Lennox Anything edition of the programme. We've done this with other people as well, as particularly N.T. Wright most recently. But today, John Lennox joins me on the programme. He's a world-renowned Christian thinker and speaker. He's Emeritus Professor of Mathematics at Oxford University, widely published author of books on atheism, science and faith. And of course, he's debated many of the leading advocates of new atheism in his time, people like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens and Lawrence Krauss. And on Saturday, the 13th of May, John is our keynote speaker at Unbelievable, the Conference 2017. Our conference title, Why Christ? How Jesus is the Answer to Life, the Universe and Everything. And before we get into today's programme and the questions you've been sending in, just a reminder, you can book in for that at premier.org.uk/Why Christ. And if you're listening in time, do it before the end of Monday, the 13th of March, to get our early bird price. You can still get the lower ticket rate if you book in before the end of Monday, the 13th of March. But today we're dispensing with the usual debate format of the show to give space for John to answer your questions, which you've been sending in via Facebook, Twitter and email on all kinds of topics: scripture, science, atheism and mathematics. So a very warm welcome along and back to the show, John Lennox. How are you doing, John?
Very well, thank you, and delighted to be with you once more.
It's great to have you, and I'm so pleased we were able to arrange this before you actually join us in person for the conference in a couple of months' time. But you're a busy man because you're actually going to be touring at the end of this month, Cork, Dublin and Belfast, I understand, a special tour, the Reason for Hope 2017 tour. This is a sort of a student union kind of arrangement, is it?
Well, it's actually called the Walton Lectures to celebrate a very famous physicist. And I shall be lecturing in the universities of Cork, Dublin and Belfast.
Brilliant. And those are going to be on things like what Stephen Hawking has had to say about
science.
Yes, that's
right. They're mostly going to be on the interface between science and faith in God.
I mean, that's what you've been doing for years and years now, John. Though, I mean, did you ever expect yourself to be going so far down the road of talking about the interface of science and faith when you started out in your career in maths?
Not at all. I was always interested, of course, because mathematics fascinated me. And then I started asking, where does mathematics fit within the overall scientific picture? And then where does science itself fit in our understanding of reality? And so those frontier areas between science, philosophy and theology have interested me since I was a teenager. So in one sense, it's a natural development, but I never thought I'd go so far down the road.
Well, if you want more information on some of the dates that John is doing in, as I say, in Cork, Dublin and Belfast, then you can go to the, I think it's facebook.com/reasons2017 is one place to find out more about that. But John, I'm excited to have you on the programme today. I've got questions of my own, but lots of questions that have come in from listeners as well. Also, we should introduce at the top of the show two guests joining me in studio today. They are Wes and Ashley Freeman from Atlanta in the USA. Welcome along to the program, guys.
Hi. Thank
you. It's great to have you here. This is a bit of a surprise that's been cooked up by you, Ashley, your wife to Wes. And Wes, celebrating his birthday, you were both due to be over in the UK, and you got in touch with me and said, could we arrange a surprise tour of the Premier Radio studios? And hey, we managed to even get you on a show as well, Wes. So
indeed, it's been a great experience. Listened to you many times and never imagined I'd be sitting across the table
from
you.
Well, given you didn't know this was going to be happening 15 minutes ago, I think you're coping very well indeed.
But screaming at the top of my lungs on the inside.
You've been listening to the show for long, Wes?
Oh, yes. Probably 3 or 4 years now.
Oh, fantastic. Great. Well, it's great to have you along.
Thank you.
We'll get to know you a bit better later on.
Terrific.
And if you can think of a question for John, maybe we can squeeze one in.
I'll be thinking as I listen.
And well done for setting this up, Ashley.
Thank you.
it's lovely to have you guys over here. Okay, we're going to get into the questions on today's programme, and we're going to see what you had to ask. All kinds of questions, the Big Bang, apologetics, what are your favourite arguments for God? All kinds of interesting questions about mathematics as well, and I'm looking forward to throwing some of those your way as well, John. Just before we get into that, it's fun as well as asking you all those technical questions to get to know you a bit as a person. And I found something out about you a few years ago now, John, but that you're actually related to a wonderful singing songwriting combo, Keith and Kristen Getty. Is that correct?
Oh, it is indeed. And Kristen Getty is my niece.
There you go.
But what is more the case, I introduced her to Keith.
Ah, you were the matchmaker. So excellent.
I was the matchmaker, yes, and I don't regret it at all, because they've written some marvellously biblical stuff and put it to magnificent music.
They have. They've really kind of, I think, set a benchmark in terms of that beautiful kind of Celtic melodies that they introduce in their music, which have travelled the world, really, and we sing many of their songs at our church, certainly. But that's just really interesting that you have that connection. There's obviously a musical strain in the family as well as the scientific.
I think there is, and of course mathematics is an imaginative pursuit, and I'm very keen on the kind of stuff they do. In fact, one of their songs, Creation Song, was actually written for me, which is
really
very flattering.
Wow. Have you ever thought of, I don't know, a pairing up in some way and you know, you speaking, them doing the singing and songwriting?
Oh, that has happened in several venues.
Great.
And may well happen again.
Fantastic. Well, I would turn up for that myself. So,
well, just don't ask me to sing.
Stick to what you know. That's the key, isn't it?
It's important.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to seeing what you have to say at some of the. And I should say, as ever, with this kind of ask so-and-so anything type of show, you haven't really had any chance to look at these questions much in advance. We're just going to be asking you to respond off the cuff to these things, John. I do love the way, though, whenever you do an event, the way you take Q&A after you've given a lecture. You have quite a unique way of doing that, John, where you basically gather in lots of questions from the audience and kind of then arrange them and manage to respond to them all in a kind of efficient and orderly manner. Why do you adopt that particular method of responding to people's questions?
There's several reasons. The first is this: if you just go one question at a time and try to answer it, the first question tends to dominate the whole of the rest of the discussion.
Yeah.
And I feel, particularly in the large audience, there are many questions in the air out there. And if you can review five or six of them, it means that everybody has heard all of those questions. And therefore, there's a spectrum. The second advantage is, of course, you can relate them to one another.
Yes.
And my uniform experience has been it gives a much better result both for the speaker and for the listeners. It's a much more effective way of using that time, which I regard as the most important time.
Well, let's make use of the time now then and get into these questions. And if you're interested in responding to anything you hear on today's programme, any of the thoughts that John brings about today's questions that he's going to be responding to, you can email your thoughts as well. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Look forward to receiving your emails. You can catch us, of course, on the social media, facebook.com/unbelievablejb to leave me your thoughts there, or indeed follow @unbelievablejb on the Twitter account for the show. All of those links available and more, and of course links to this year's Unbelievable Conference in a couple of months' time, which John will be speaking at, from the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So let's get into some of the questions you've been asking John Lennox. It's our special Ask John Lennox Anything edition of the programme today on Unbelievable. And John, I've had quite a few from Christians who wanted to know about generally apologetics and arguments for God and some of your thinking when it comes to the way you interact with people, the books you've written, the talks you give and so on. Jason, for instance, got in touch on Facebook to say, I've always appreciated how calm and courteous you remain when debating, especially when the other person is doing their best to try and throw you off. Has this always been the case for you, or is this something you've learned over time? And what advice would you give to people like myself who still find it difficult not to get their backs up? Okay, so I guess it's, yeah, how do you deal with it when people are throwing things at you in order to kind of get you riled up?
Well, I think it's very important to realise that if you lose your cool, then the argument goes. Mm. And if other people are angry with me, that's fine. It usually indicates that their argument may be relatively weak. But standing back from it, Justin, I think that it's so important to distinguish between the argument and the person bringing the argument. Mm. And I try to avoid that kind of ad hominem attacking the person. Attack the argument by all means, but do it in a friendly way. And that means that your audience has real space to think about the content of the argument. And I suppose it's true. I've had to learn it. Although coming from Ireland, I saw enough of the opposite kind of thing to run away from it
sure.
for a mile. But it is so important that you mustn't take people who are angry with you as a reason to get angry with them, because that will be the end of any convincing power you've got in what you have to say.
I mean, I'd just be fascinated to know when you're doing some of those high profile discussions and debates you've had with people like Dawkins and of course, you know, the late Christopher Hitchens you shared a platform with as well. Did you find that you got on with them off the stage, or was it kind of, you know, you kind of saved up the conversation for the actual stuff you were doing in public?
Well, sometimes the latter was the only possibility, because I'd never met Richard Dawkins before I met him on the stage, so to speak. I'd had a very brief lunchtime Q&A with him, but it was formal and public. Whereas with Christopher Hitchens, I'd much more time off stage to get to know him and to a certain extent to befriend him.
Mm.
And I always feel that if you can befriend a person, even on stage, it changes the dynamic of the interaction completely and to profit.
Yeah, I think there is a place for a kind of a bit of a, not hostile, but at least a debatey kind of feel. But then if you can actually throw in a few laughs, I think it often helps to relax people almost, doesn't it, when you're having that kind of...
Well, it does. Discussion. One mustn't take oneself too seriously, but one mustn't shirk telling what one believes the truth to be.
Sure.
And I think the balance, and it's a very difficult one, is that famous statement of the Apostle Paul, speaking the truth in love. And the danger is you can become sentimental and miss the truth point, or you can be hard and aggressive with truth, and of course nobody then listens to you.
Yeah. I've got another one here from a Paul Justin, who asks, what three things do you feel are the most important skills you'd advise new Christian apologists to equip themselves with? Now, I won't say you have to have three up your sleeve, John, but any particular skills that you would say, you know, develop this if you're looking to make an impact in Christian apologetics?
Well, the very first thing is to learn to listen. We've got two ears and one mouth, and perhaps we should use them in that proportion, which is, I know, very difficult for an Irishman. But listening to what they actually have to say, and listening also not simply to the argument, but to the person behind it. Mm. Secondly, I think not claiming to know something when you don't, being honest with your own ignorance, because we're all humans. And the more we can appear to be on the level with each other, the better. And of course, the point I made earlier, attack arguments by all means, but don't attack people.
Yeah.
And try to speak in such a way that your argument communicates beyond the immediate opponent. In other words, make it audience friendly so far as you can, rather than dressing it up in obscure language that's only accessible to two or three people.
Yes, I fully appreciate that. Interestingly, actually, on that comment, one of the other people commenting on this Facebook thread that it was on got in touch. Gaia, who I think is an atheist herself, says, if it means anything, Paul, I find that when an apologist is calm and pleasant, it goes a million miles. Not trying to win me to Christ actually matters, and no one is going to win a conversation or even a debate, in my humble opinion. When people just talk, that's where relationships are formed. I think Justin comes from that mindset as well. If John is asked the question, I look forward to his answer. He seems like a likable fella, so I'm guessing that works nicely for him. There you go.
Well, that's very nice of whoever Gaia is. I think the point is substantive, though, because consciously when I go into these debates or discussions, I'm not trying to win.
Mm.
What I'm trying to do is to put out into the public space an alternative to, say, the atheism that my colleague is going to present, and let the people make their minds up. And I think that relaxes things a great deal. I'm not trying to win, because one of the dangers there emotionally is that leads people to make shortcuts to win cheap points in the evening. Mm. And that has no depth to it. So present evidence and trust the people to be able to make their minds up.
Yeah. Well, sticking with Gaia, because she also asked a question, and I think it's a really interesting question, actually, and one that I find quite hard to answer, actually. She says, atheists are always asked, what would it take for you to believe? But what would it take for you not to believe? So is there something that could be presented to you, John, where you would say, actually, yeah, I accept, I can no longer be a Christian or a theist? And it's hard, but what do you think that might be, if there was such a thing?
I think it's a very important question to ask, because sometimes people say to me, you're a Christian and a scientist, but that's absurd, because in science things are testable. In Christianity, they're not. Mm. Well, I don't know where they got that idea, because one of the reasons I'm a Christian is that it is testable. Now, I'll come to that in a moment. Mm. But to face this question head on, what would it take me to reject my belief? Well, certain things would have to be demonstrated to me. First of all, that the Gospels were totally unreliable. Secondly, that Jesus didn't do the things claimed of him, that the resurrection did not occur, that the events predicted, say, in the Old Testament centuries before they happened, that is all coincidence. So there's a whole series of objective things that I would want to see evidence for. But secondly, on the subjective side, the experiential side, when one has lived as long as I have and seen so frequently the connection between a step of commitment and trust in Jesus Christ and a transformation of life, I would want to see evidence that there's no connection, that people who, for example, were in despair of their lives, as I've seen among students, you meet them 6 months later and they're radiant, and you say, what's happened to you? And they say something like, well, I've come to trust Christ, I've become a Christian, I've met Jesus, something like that. When you see that again and again, where alcohol is turned into peace and so on, you begin to put two and two together. And one would have to demonstrate to me that those things are purely coincidental, that there's no connection at all. Mm. So I find that the question is perfectly valid. And it's worth, of course, putting it back on the atheists, as Gaius quite fairly suggests.
Yeah, yeah. It's something I've often taken to sometimes asking an atheist guest at the end of a discussion on Unbelievable.
Yes.
And it's interesting because I've sometimes found that when you actually ask the atheist who's asking for evidence for God or Christ, well, what would it take to convince you? It turns out it's very difficult to really get clear on what that would be, because in a sense, depending on how high your skeptometer is dialed, if you like, you know, even Jesus appearing before you could just be some strange brain hallucination and that kind of thing. So I sometimes wonder if you're very committed to naturalism, almost any kind of evidence could have some kind of a naturalistic explanation.
Well, of course, that's always true. And we must try and unearth in the middle of all this the truth question. There will always be these ways of psychologically going about it that you can explain anything away. But we've got to have some detector that tells us when we are really explaining and when we're explaining away, and to tell the difference between the two. And that isn't always easy.
No. Here's another kind of connected question, John, from Daniel, also on Facebook, and we'll go to some Twitter questions in a moment too. Says, given it is evangelical apologists who seem to constantly feel the need to defend the idea that Christianity is science-friendly and rational, does Lennart consider atheist philosophers such as Schellenberg to be science-friendly, rational, and reasonable? So I suppose the overall question is, you know, there are lots of very intelligent, rational people, philosophers who arrive at very different conclusions to you, John, in terms of the compatibility of Christianity and science. Are they therefore not in fact rational and reasonable if they've arrived at a different conclusion?
Well, of course, that's not true. I was very interested in the way this question is put, that evangelical apologists feel the need to defend the idea that Christianity is science-friendly and rational. It's not so much that I feel the need to defend that idea. It's that in the public space, there are many very vocal people saying that Christianity is antagonistic to science and irrational. And if they do that, then there arises the important task of pointing out that that is actually false. So the first thing is to deal with the fact that Christianity and God are not hostile to science. Now, the question, the second part of it, do I consider philosophers like Schellenberg and so on to be science-friendly, rational, and reasonable? That's asking me to make a subjective judgment on the level of their rationality, reasonableness, and science-friendliness. But the rationality and reasonableness, I assume when I read their books, because I have many atheist friends, and I emphasize the word friend, who are very brilliant people. And it's important to realize that Christians don't have the monopoly on brain power. Of course they don't. There are equally brilliant atheist scientists, say, Nobel Prize winners, and Christians who've won the Nobel Prize. So the presumption is not that these people are all irrational, but they've used their ability to think up arguments. And I show my respect for them by the amount of time I spend trying to dissect those arguments. What concerns me very much is that I find the weight is actually the other way round. It's many atheists just think there's no rationality at all in Christian thinkers, and they airbrush out centuries of Christian thought. And because of that, because they assume, for instance, that John Lennox is a man of faith, which they have redefined to be believing where there's no evidence, they're not prepared to consider the evidence I offered. That does not impress me. And I think the evidence goes the exact opposite direction to your questioner.
Sticking with another sort of fairly full-on atheist question here from one person who goes by the name Chris Cross. This and he sometimes sounds cross.
You've some marvelous.
yes, but given his claim to be a man of science, says Chris, why is belief in God incompatible with the scientific method? That's the assertion of Chris. Why does the method for believing in God share the same flaws as belief in fairies, 9/11 conspiracy, and homeopathy? Namely, that when it's subject to honest and detailed scrutiny, it's found to be nothing more than wishful thinking based on ignorance. Surely a real personal God would leave behind a lot more evidence of his existence than a paltry collection of endlessly reinterpretable ancient scriptures and intellectually dishonest argumentation. Okay, so it's a rather a loaded question, this one.
Well, it's so loaded, it's an evidence of the thing that it's against.
Right.
It is a perfect evidence of the kind of statement it makes, because when I look at that question, it is found to be nothing more than wishful thinking based on ignorance. And what comes across to me, sorry to be fairly abrupt with this, is that someone who has seriously investigated any of the evidence, say for the resurrection of Jesus, to say that it's incompatible with the scientific method, that's nonsense. What is the scientific method? It's to assess evidence and to base your conclusions on the evidence. Why does the method for believing in God share the same flaws as belief in fairies? But it doesn't. And it just strikes me that this person has not done the work that they would expect of other people. So I'm afraid I'm not. It's a classic example of wishful thinking.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, we'll leave that one there for the moment, and we'll come back for more questions in a moment's time. This is a special edition of Unbelievable, asking John Lennox all sorts of questions that you've sent in via Twitter, Facebook, and email. I've got questions on maths coming up as well. John is, of course, a mathematician by background, and we're going to be asking questions around whether that is a kind of a real sort of element of our world, that the mathematical structure of the universe and so on, and John's thoughts on that. There's also more questions about science and faith and the Bible that we'll be asking, and we'll try and chuck in a few other sorts of questions as well as we go along. So if you want to get in touch about today's programme, as ever, you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Look forward to receiving emails. We'll read out some of your feedback towards the end of today's show as well. And don't forget, you can get in touch on the Twitter, the Facebook, and of course, underneath today's show at the website. Be interested to hear your responses yourself to what John had to say there. That's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links, of course, to this year's Unbelievable Conference happening Saturday, 13th of May. So pleased that John Lennox is going to be our keynote speaker at this year's conference. Go and find out more about it at the website. Book yourself in as well before the early bird ends on Monday, the 13th of March. So if you can get in there in time, well worth doing that. Find out more. Book in at premier.org.uk/whyChrist, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes. Martin Luther King described 11 o'clock on Sunday morning as the most segregated hour in Christian America. The same is still true today in the UK. In the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine, we explore the great divide between black and white churches and what can be done to unify them again. You'll also meet the wave of refugees seeking asylum and finding Christ, discover why modern archaeology is confirming the New Testament, and find out what tech pioneer Elon Musk has to say to today's church. All that plus much more. Why not ask for a free copy of our March magazine at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's programme. This is Unbelievable, the show that often brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate, dispensing though with the usual format just for this week, as I have a special one-to-one with John Lennox. John is well known for his appearances on Unbelievable over the years, his books, and of course his career as a mathematician, and indeed as someone who's a Christian thinker and has often been involved in public debates with leading advocates of new atheism over the years. And John, going to be speaking at this year's Unbelievable Unbelievable, the conference 2017 on Saturday, the 13th of May. Really looking forward to that, plus all the other speakers, of course, who'll be joining us across that day. If you want to find out more, go to the website, premierchristianradio.com/whychrist. We'll take you there. We've been going through a number of questions about atheism, Christianity, apologetics, and that kind of thing. You've been sending them in over the last week or so by Twitter and by Facebook, and of course a few by email as well. Hitting as many of these as we can across the course of today's programme. Again, if you want to email in yourself about today's show, I'll be giving out the ways to get in touch later on. Don't forget that straight after today's programme on Unbelievable, you can hear The Profile, and you're going to be hearing another Christian talking about their walk of faith and life. That's between 4 and 5 this Saturday afternoon. So John, coming back to you, it's often, you know, something that people don't necessarily hear you talking about that much, because you're often talking about science and faith. But it all started with mathematics for you. Before I come to some questions that people had to ask about what you believe about mathematics, where did it begin for you with mathematics? Was that just a passion you had as a young person growing up?
Well, when I was a child, I found myself intrigued by arithmetic. I think I was the only child in my class who constantly asked for extra homework. And I had good mathematics teachers. That makes a very big difference. Although my initial interests when I got older were to study languages, either ancient or modern, and then I shifted to being interested in electrical engineering. But the concentration in mathematics resulted from a suggestion by my headmaster that I might just get it to Cambridge, but I'd have to do maths to get in because the school couldn't teach to a high enough level in other fields. So that's how that was decided.
Well, there you go. It's funny how circumstances work out that way.
Though
you described earlier that you do think of mathematics as an imaginative subject. That's not often what people would think of when they think of mathematics.
Well, one is often asked, is mathematics created or invented? And I say it's both, because it is an activity of a person. And I believe that as persons, we reflect the image of God. We are created in his image. And God is an imaginative creator. And so part of it, I think, reflects the structure of the universe, but part of it is something that we can play with and invent. It's a very creative kind of field.
I had a question along those lines from Neil Goff, who asks, is math a fundamental of the universe, or is it a tool we've developed to understand the universe? And one person actually got in touch to say, I can answer that one for you. A man has always had the need to quantify things, be it from the number of sheep in their flock or the area of their land. And we've simply developed a way to describe this, and we now call it mathematics. So that particular person, Matthew Hunt, sort of weighing in there on that comment that was left to say it's evidently something that we just come up with. It's created by us. But what's your view on this? Is it somehow more fundamental? Is it out there to be discovered in some way?
I think it's both. I think it's certainly out there. There's a famous paper written by Eugene Wigner in the 1960s. He won the Nobel Prize for Physics. And it's called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics, and raises the question, how is it that mathematics, which we appear to be thinking up in our own mind, seems to cog so closely in with what's going on out there in the universe? So it would seem that there are aspects of the universe that are not simply describable in mathematics, but there's something fundamentally mathematical that is embodied in them. So I feel it goes more than description. By the way, counting sheep is a long way from modern sophisticated mathematics, and there's no way in which counting sheep could lead to that without something significantly other being involved.
I mean, I remember when we looked into this issue of the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics a little while back, and I think it's something that William Lane Craig has used in a few debates as another kind of pointer towards the existence of God. I think what's fascinating is that it's almost as though sometimes we can come up with maths which doesn't immediately have any application, and then suddenly find it does map on in some incredible way to the way we then begin to understand the
universe. That is absolutely correct. For example, the whole iPhones and electronics and internet and so on is based on an imaginary concept, the square root of minus one, which when you first meet it, you think, how can this be useful? But has turned out to be of huge use.
Mm.
And I myself also am prepared to argue from the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics to the existence of God. Because, to cut a long story short, I do not think atheism has any explanation whatsoever of the effectiveness of mathematics. In fact, any explanation whatsoever of mathematics. Now, that's a huge topic. But it seems to me that the structure of the universe and the mathematical description of it fits much better with the existence of the mind of God than simply with the outworking of the permutations of various elementary particles that don't ultimately know what they're doing.
And when famous mathematicians and physicists of the past have said things like, you know, for them we shall know the mind of God, or we're thinking God's thoughts after him, is that what they had in mind, do you think?
I think that's possibly true. I do think that when we begin to understand, certainly people like Newton and so on, Clark Maxwell did feel like that. They were finding out something that's actually true of the universe. And the mathematical description of it was so beautiful that even at the aesthetic level, it pointed beyond itself to a brilliant mind that had somehow conceived it.
There's another question here on mathematics, and this takes us into slightly sort of deep philosophical territory. One of them was from someone on Twitter. This was Nolan Whitaker, who says, are you a realist about abstract objects, for example, numbers, sets, etc.? And then also on Facebook, in similar manner, there was one from, Rob Knetch, who says, do you believe, like William Lane Craig, that numbers have their own kind of platonic existence that also seems to lead to an argument for the existence of God? Maybe you'll have to spell this one out first for us as to what's being referenced here, John, and then what your take is on it.
Well, when we think of tables and chairs and stars, we tend to regard those as real.
Mm.
And then when we think of numbers and mathematics, we realize very rapidly that this is abstract. So it's not in the same category as tables and chairs. But is it real? And I would want to argue, yes, it is real, because there are real immaterial things. Now, of course, once you've said that, you're coming head on against a dominant philosophy in our world, that of materialism.
Mm.
And what I find quite ironic is that even the most die-hard materialist has to accept, I believe, that things like numbers are not material. They are abstract. They're immaterial. And that immaterial realities are as important as material realities for our understanding of the world. Whether Plato had the idea that the numbers existed in some other kind of realm. Now, whether that really informs our imagination correctly or not, I'm not sure. But the thought behind it, that they do have an existence that impresses itself upon us, that I find myself very favourable to.
Hmm. And in that sense, is it, I suppose, a kind of a rebuttal to those who would say that all we have is physical matter? If there is actually some realm of existence in which there these things do exist that obviously don't have a physical nature, but that they these abstract concepts of numbers and so on, that itself suggests that at the very least the atheist materialist is not explaining the nature of our universe correctly.
Oh, I think that is correct, and perhaps the clearer way to put it is not simply in terms of mathematics, but in terms of information. Because we live in the information age, and we're aware that information, say of the kind that's in a computer code or in the DNA code and so on, that information is not material, although it's carried on material carriers. But the thing that's increasingly obvious, I believe, even to some leading atheists like Thomas Nagel, is that you cannot explain information in terms of the material carriers. You can't explain a Rembrandt painting simply in terms of the materials, canvas and ink. And nor is that information, therefore, that constitutes the picture reducible to those materials. It belongs to a different category, which is equally real and equally important. And therefore, that resonates with me much more with the statement in Scripture, in the beginning was the Word. All things were made through him. In other words, the Word is basic to the universe, is prime. The mass energy is derivative, and it's not the other way around. We cannot explain information, mind, consciousness, simply by studying mass and energy.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, though, that Nagel, despite sort of having written that book, Mind and Cosmos, and putting the backs up of plenty of the sort of more traditional materialist atheists out there, still obviously doesn't want to arrive at a God conclusion from recognizing that there's something that needs explaining that the materialist concept doesn't explain. So he doesn't appear to think that it has to lead to God necessarily.
No, it's very interesting. And he's very honest, Nagel. That's why I like reading him so much. He's a hard atheist. He says himself in one of his writings, he doesn't even want there to be a God.
Mm.
Now, how much that affects his willingness to follow where his philosophical questionings are leading, I'm not in a position to judge, but it shows that there are other things are playing a role.
Yes, indeed. Let's talk and this was another question that came in, more of a pastoral question, I suppose, on the math side. John David Walters on Twitter asks, how can maths teachers at Christian schools, and I assume that's where John is perhaps teaching, teach the subject and imbibe respect for its divine origin? Any tips for anyone, I suppose, whether they're a Christian in a secular or Christian school, actually teaching maths, and how they can perhaps put across the fact this isn't just a dry, I guess, logical subject. It bespeaks something of the nature of our universe.
Well, first of all, I think that if a maths teacher can really get kids excited by understanding some of the fascinating things within mathematics, that goes a long way to increase their sense of wonder. And I think it starts there. It's the wonder, both in mathematics and science and so on. And wonder naturally leads to connect that with a wonderful God who created it that way. Now, the second thing that I would want to say in that connection, it's not simply mathematics, but science as a whole, is the connection between the rise of modern science in the 16th and 17th centuries and faith in God on the part of people like Galileo, Kepler, Newton, and so on. And I still think, with all the variations and nuances of various historians of science, I still think there's a lot to be said for C.S. Lewis's summary when he said, men became scientific because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. That far from belief in God hindering their science and mathematics, it was their belief in God that was the motor that drove it.
Mm, yeah.
And when, for example, Newton discovered the law of gravitation, he didn't react by saying, well, now I've got a mathematical formula at the back of gravity, I don't need God. No, his reaction was, what a genius of a God who did it that way. And if you can awaken that kind of connection in kids' minds, you've done a great deal.
It would be great to move on to some questions, John, about sort of the science, the Big Bang. Those kinds of things have come up in various mm-hmm. forms. Before we get to that, I've got one more on a very famous atheist of the last century, Bertrand Russell. This one was from Mark Frost, who said, it'd be interesting to know your views of Bertrand Russell's famous talk and essay, Why I Am Not a Christian. Now, this is relevant to me, actually, because I'm about to release a promo video for the conference in which I directly talk about Bertrand Russell's famous Why I Am Not a Christian booklet, because it's actually 90 years ago this year that was released and circulated. And in some ways, he beat all the new atheists to it when it came to a best-selling publication, didn't he, John, with that one? But are you familiar with Why I'm Not a Christian?
Well, I didn't read it 90 years ago, but I read it 55 years ago.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And there's a story connected with it. I saw it in the window of a bookshop in Cambridge when I was a student. And I knew about Russell, of course, and his fame as a philosopher and mathematician and so on. And I thought, dare I buy this? Is it going to sink my Christian faith? And I remember walking up and down the street and I thought, hey, I think of myself as someone who's fair to the other arguments. I got to read this, and I bought it. Mm. And I found it one of the most helpful books in establishing my Christian faith. Because my immediate impression was Russell doesn't know anything about Christianity nor the evidence for it. What size of a circle of friends has he really got? Now, it had such a positive impulse on me that I now make this confession. I haven't read it since. So I look forward to your introduction of it.
Yeah.
But it happens again and again when you face these things. You see, well, these arguments don't really hold any water or any real water. And so it confirmed to me the importance, and that was a very, very good lesson for me. Mm. Face out anything, even if you're initially afraid of it.
Yes, I think that's great advice. And I think in some ways it would be interesting to know how Russell would respond today to some of the evidences that weren't available, obviously, when he was writing. You know, the Big Bang cosmology, the fine-tuning of the universe, all those aspects, you know, that many people would say do have, you know, appear to point towards God weren't accessible to him at the time.
No, they weren't. And it would be interesting to see, by the same token, which arguments he would have favoured, which he would have thought were the best atheist arguments. You know, it's an interesting question. I once did a debate with a leading philosopher here in Oxford, and he said to me in advance, he said, I hope you're going to use your best argument. And I said, are you prepared to tell me what that is? He said, of course I am. Of course I am. And that was interesting. I said, what is it? Oh, he said, the best argument, if I were ever to become a Christian, it would be because of fine tuning would point me towards God. Mm. So please use that argument. And I did. So it's interesting that some atheists even have favorite arguments that they like to hear Christians using.
Well, that was my experience. And I don't know if it possibly was him, but Peter Milliken, when I've had him on
the show.
That's
exactly him.
There you go.
Yes,
there
it was
go.
Peter.
Right. Yes, he said the same to me when I've had him on the show before. But lovely stuff. This is just my own personal question here then, John, but knowing that you go back a while and growing, you know, when you were a student in Cambridge, I think you even intersected with the teaching of C.S. Lewis while he was still with us.
Do
you have any memories of C.S. Lewis from back in the
day? Oh, very clear. Very clear.
Would you relate one or two of them for us?
Well, in 1962, when I went up to Cambridge, I had read almost all of Lewis's books, including the semi-technical ones, because I was a voracious reader. And I knew he was there. I didn't know he was dying. Mm. But his lecture theatre for the English faculty was just across Mill Lane from the maths department. So I occasionally sneaked out and went to Lewis's lecture. And I'm glad I did, because I heard the very last lectures he gave on John Donne. Mm. And the living memory, the vivid memory of that is that it was very cold. He'd burst into the room through the double doors, lecture room packed, people on the floor and the windows. And he, a big heavy man wearing a big coat and a long scarf and a hat, he would start lecturing immediately he came through the door. And he would gradually divest himself of his outer garments so that by the time he got to the podium, you'd had 5 minutes of a brilliantly delivered lecture. And so he lectured through the 50 minutes and then he reversed the process. He kept lecturing as he put on his hat, wound up his scarf, put on his coat, and the last few words were delivered as he crashed out through the double doors. There was no time for Q&A.
That's great. That's great. What an amazing memory to have of someone who has obviously had such an extraordinary impact on so many people.
And a huge influence on me.
Yes, I was going to say, sometime later, he's been a huge influence on me as well. But was it because he opened up the whole idea of the rationale, the reason that goes alongside faith?
Well, I came across Lewis early through my father, and it was just the refreshing quality of the argument that Christianity was rationally defensible. And as my interest in mathematics grew, I discovered that Lewis, although no mathematician, in fact, we nearly didn't have Lewis because of mathematics. He was forced to sit an examination to get into Oxford called Responsions, and he failed it. And it was the war that saved Lewis for us, otherwise we'd never have heard of him. They let him into Oxford in the end. But he had a very good geometrical intuition. Mm. And he used geometry very effectively in helping us imagine ideas that would be normally quite difficult, like the Trinity and so on. Mm. But I think it's his absolutely clear-cut logic and his conviction that there is a supernatural world that he articulated brilliantly. And that became a bedrock for me in approaching the New Testament and the miracles of Christ and so on, that supernatural is rationally defensible. It's not irrational.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about some of the other questions that have come in, John, and I'm afraid we've only been able to graze the surface of many of the questions that have come in, but we've got a few here on sort of things like the Big Bang and cosmology and so on. Mm-hmm. And one of the key areas that has often come up and is talked about in your books is Big Bang and whether that specifically, you know, has any relevance to the existence of God as a first cause and so on. For instance, on Facebook, Philip John Lohman asks, is the coming into existence of matter ex nihilo coherent or possible? And I've got another one here from Kenneth on email, who says, I've heard John Lennox talk about the Big Bang. In a scientific explanation of the universe, there's no need for any being once that bang has taken place. So how can I, as a Christian, affirm the need for God once the Big Bang has taken place? Maybe he's more like the God of the deists, as once the bang takes place, the rest seems to happen by itself. So two different questions there. The first one about whether the idea of things coming into existence ex nihilo is coherent itself, and then this question about whether God's sort of made a bit redundant by the Big Bang.
Well, ex nihilo, of course, is Latin for from nothing. And I'm glad to have lived to the time when the cosmologists, on the basis of their own physical and astronomical theories, are now in the position, most of them anyway, of believing that space-time had a start, and before that there was nothing. And they are therefore faced with this question, which is much loved by philosophers. Why is there something rather than nothing? Mm. And there's been a whole plethora of books written by people like Stephen Hawking and Lawrence Krauss and so on, trying to get a universe from nothing, which appears to me, as I analyze their arguments, to be a very difficult thing to do, if not impossible. You see, the Christian position, as I understand it, is that the universe came from nothing physical. It didn't come from nothing. Mm. It was created by God, who is spirit. But now if you remove God as the initiator, as the creator, you simply got nothing. And how do you get something from nothing? And it strikes me that the only way you can do it, which is a complete cheat, is by redefining nothing. It's very striking that in Hawking's book, Krauss's book, you will find that nothing now becomes very much something to do with quantum fields, quantum vacuum, and so on and so forth. And I once was invited to do a kind of mini debate with Alan Guth at the MIT Faculty Club, Harvard MIT Faculty Club. And Alan Guth is the father of inflation, one of those very big ideas in current cosmology that after the beginning there was a sudden, very rapid inflationary time. And during the question session, I said, Alan, I have a question that I'd love to ask you. So he said, go ahead. I said, you know, out there, there's in, among the public, there's much ado about nothing. And the question of a universe from nothing. Now, tell me as a cosmologist, when you use the word nothing, do you mean what all the rest of us mean when we use it. That is the absence of anything. He said, no, we do not. And I said, thank you very much. They haven't actually got a universe from nothing. And Stephen Hawking makes it very clear. He's written a book, co-authored with Leonard Mlodinow, called The Grand Design. And the heart of that book is a single sentence. Here's his main argument. Because there is a law of gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. And when I read that, I was so astonished by it that I wrote a book about it. You know, looking at the statement, because there is a law of gravity, that is, because there is something, the universe will create itself from nothing. That's just a flat contradiction. To say nothing of the sheer nonsense involved in the universe creating itself. If I say X creates Y, roughly speaking, I mean, if I've got X, I'll get Y. If I say X creates X, well, what does that mean? If I've got X, I'll get X, which simply tells me that nonsense is nonsense, even if physicists write it. And the most amazing one, Justin, that I've ever read is Lawrence Krauss, who's written a whole book, A Universe from Nothing.
Well, you came on to debate him a few years ago now on that very subject, didn't you?
On your program, right. Yes. But his statement must really rank as one of the most absurd statements I've ever read. He says, I quote, because something is physical, nothing must be physical, especially if you define it as the absence of something. Well, this is just ridiculous. And what it tells me is that people are prepared to go to absurd lengths, very clever people, to get rid of the impasse you get into when you try to get something from nothing without having some other very substantial input, like the input from a creator.
We're going to have to take a quick break, and we'll be back just for a final 5 minutes, John.
Okay.
And, great stuff, though. Thank you very much. This is Ask John Lennox Anything. That's what we're titling today's program here on Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, your show host, firing a whole host of questions that you've asked John via social media and email. And we'll maybe fit in one more from my studio guest as well, Wes Freeman, who is here as a bit of a birthday treat on behalf of his wife, Ashley. So we'll hear what Wes has to ask John as well after a short break.
How can I know it's true?
What about other religions?
Why Christ? Join me, Justin Brierley, to find answers at Unbelievable The Conference 2017. Discover how Jesus is the answer to life, the universe, and everything, and how to share him with others. Plus, I'll be launching my new book and sharing why I'm still a Christian after 10 years of talking with atheists. It's in London on Saturday the 13th of May with great speakers, including Professor John Lennox, Beth Grove, Andy Bannister, and Jeremiah J. Johnston of our conference partner, the Christian Thinkers Society. Early bird tickets are available now at premier.org.uk/whychrist.
Welcome back to today's programme, Unbelievable, with me, Justin Brierley. This is the place where Christians and non-Christians get together for dialogue and debate. And if you go back to our archives online, download the podcast and look at some of the features at the website, you'll see that we've done all kinds of debates on all kinds of subjects over the years. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. But dispensing with the usual format this week, just to be able to ask John Lennox anything. Yes, we asked for your thoughts and comments and questions to come in via social media and email, and I've been firing them at the Oxford mathematician and a Christian thinker and speaker. He's going to be appearing at this year's Unbelievable Conference on Saturday, the 13th of May. So if you're able to come along, I do encourage you. It's going to be a great day where we're able to sit down, think and talk together about some of the reasons why Christianity makes sense of the universe. It's in fact titled Why Christ? How Jesus is the Answer to Life, the Universe and Everything. If you want to find out more, premier.org.uk/whychrist. And if you're listening before the end of Monday the 13th of March, not too late to get the early bird price as well, but still well worth coming along if you're listening at a later date. There's group discounts, there's last year's conference on DVD if you book two or more tickets, and lots more besides. Also, again, a mention that John is in Cork, Dublin and Belfast towards the end of March and the beginning of April, doing a number of lectures there, and you can find out more about that as well at facebook.com/reasons2017. So we've been firing some of your questions at John over the course of the last hour, and we're going to be continuing to do that in a moment's time. Just a reminder that after Unbelievable, we're going to be hearing The Profile, and you'll be able to hear more Christians talking about their walk of faith and life between 4 and 5 this afternoon. I've got a really interesting debate on next week's programme. Looking forward to this. Theo Hobson is the author of a new book called God Created Humanism, a bit of a provocative title, and he's going to be in discussion with the leader of the British Humanist Association, the director, Andrew Copson. And so look forward to that. That should be a really sparkling discussion on next week's programme as we hear those two going head-to-head on Unbelievable. But right now, let's get back into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So John Lennox has been answering your questions on the programme today. As I've mentioned, John joining me on Saturday the 13th of May for Unbelievable Conference 2017. We didn't quite get time to wrap up that last question that was being talked about in the last section, John, particularly that issue of, well, if God is responsible for the Big Bang, does that mean God sort of just sat back from then on? Is it not evidence for a deist kind of God rather than the God who interacts and is involved with the world? What's your feel on that?
Well, certainly the first thing to say is that the concept of the Big Bang is, in one sense, a label on a mystery, and it's simply claiming that there was a beginning. Now, if you, as I do, believe that God was the beginner, you're not obliged to believe that God let the whole thing run. That is actually a viewpoint, as you say, called deism, and it's really saying God has no more involvement with the world. But the God I believe in is the God revealed by the Bible, who's very much involved with space, time and history. And a large part of the revelation, on the basis of which I believe that Jesus is the Son of God, has to do with God's interaction with history, with people, and the evidence of those central events that Christians have claimed to be the basis of their faith. For instance, his resurrection from the dead and so on. You can, of course, believe in a deistic God, but it seems to me to leave unanswered the whole question of one's relationship with God. Christianity is not deism, it's far more.
John, thanks for being with us on the programme today. I'm going to leave the last question, if he's thought up one in the course of being in the studio, to Wes, who's my just coming in to see what happens behind the scenes on Unbelievable. You've seen how messy it is in real life, Wes. Is it a bit of an eye-opener to see what goes on?
It has been eye-opening. I still think you do it masterfully.
That's
really appreciate the model that you present on interacting with people.
Oh, thank you, Wes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you have a question for John before he has to go?
I do. I was wondering if you had anything to say to people like me who at times struggle. We get so caught up with these questions and are so fascinated by them, we get stuck in our heads often and perhaps don't relate a lot of the things that we think about to our Christian walk. And so I was just wondering if you had anything to say about relating that to your Christian walk and perhaps the role of the affections in your Christian walk and how there might be interplay between your grand thoughts that you have with mathematics and all of these things and perhaps where the rubber meets the road of your Christian walk.
The rubber meets the road in many places. One of them is the intellectual space that we have been discussing most of the time. But you're perfectly right that Christianity is not simply a theory, an explanatory edifice built up so that we might understand. God isn't a theory, he's a person. And Christ is not a theory, he's a person. And therefore, the question of relationship with him is something just as important, I would say more important, than many of the things that we have been discussing during this program. I tend to address questions that people bring to me, and some of them, as today, most of them, are intellectual questions. But Christianity, if it's going to be credible, must have an effect in our lives, and we need to live it out. And it's a very good question to end on, so that we don't just finish in some kind of intellectual space which is not accessible to everybody. And I would stress very strongly that, and I just hinted at it, that Christianity is testable. Christ claims that if we trust him for salvation, facing the mess we've made of our own lives and sometimes those of others, that we receive forgiveness and peace with God. Those are quantities and qualities that ought to be evidenced in our lives. And our Christianity is only going to be credible as we reflect those things, because the world out there is hurting and people need friendship. They need forgiveness. They need to discover a way in which they can have peace. And all of those things we must constantly attend to. And that's why it's very important for me to regularly be into Scripture, not simply into science and the Christian faith, but relating to Scripture and praying, and in particular in my family with my wife, bringing these things before God so that all of life is a living experience of the living God. Because I firmly believe that whatever we do, we can do it as unto the Lord, not only our devotions, but our science. But we must do the devotions as well as the science.
Great stuff. Thank you very much, John, for joining me on the program today. And I'm thoroughly looking forward to seeing you in May for the conference. But until then, thank you very much for being with me.
My pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you.
Thank you, John. And it's also time to say goodbye to my studio guests, who have been Ashley and Wes Freeman. And if you weren't listening from earlier on the show, you wouldn't have heard me describe the fact that Wes has been sitting in on the show as a bit of a surprise birthday gift from his wife, Ashley. You guys from Atlanta. But have you been enjoying your stay in the UK so far?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
You're over here kind of on a graduate program, I think. Is that right?
I was. Ashley? It's finished now. We were here from Sunday to Friday studying Brexit. We're from Emory University's Goyce Wedda Business School in Atlanta, Georgia.
Great. And Wes, you've come over now for a bit of holiday time.
That's right. We've just been enjoying London. It's a lovely city.
Is it your first time?
Yes, Wes? It is.
Great. What's your background, though? I'd just be interested to know sort of how this sort of works in terms of your interests in life and so on.
I mean, I was raised in the church. And, you know, I think once I got to college, I started having a lot of questions and learned about C.S. Lewis and did a lot of reading of his. And was introduced to your show probably several years ago, I think looking around for N.T. Wright. And I came across his episode with James White and listened to that. And then I kind of got hooked. I've been listening every week ever since and catching up on some of the older episodes as well.
Great. So. Well, thank you guys for coming in today. I hope you enjoyed seeing how things work behind the scenes. You'll never listen to Unbelievable in the same way now that the magic has been dispelled, you know. The wizard's curtain has been drawn back from Oz and you're seeing how it all works. But I hope you've nonetheless enjoyed the experience.
Absolutely have.
Very grateful for the opportunity. Thank you.
Great.
Yeah,
and
thank you.
We'll go and catch a coffee after we've finished recording today. Terrific. But thank you as well for listening. We've got some of your feedback coming up in the final part of today's program. And again, I'll be giving out the ways to get in touch if you'd like to respond to anything you heard on today's program.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, it'd be great to get your thoughts about today's show. You can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk, tweet me @unbelievablejb, or send it via Facebook, facebook.com/unbelievablejb, for the Facebook page of today's show, regularly updated there with other interesting articles and bits and pieces if you want to follow the programme via Facebook. Also, of course, I've had lots of other emails for John Lennox with lots of other questions that we couldn't get to or that simply arrived too late for our recording. So apologies if you didn't get your question read out, but why not come down to the conference and ask him for yourself, because we always make time for Q&A at every conference when it comes to our speakers and the things they're presenting. You get to meet them as well during the breaks and that kind of thing. There's always a long queue of people at the stage whenever someone's finished presenting at Unbelievable, the conference. So I do encourage you to try and make your way over for it if you possibly can. Loads of emails regarding the Hindu program from last week. Hinduism, Krishna and Christ debated between Deepan Rajaguru and Ken Samples. We've also got lots of responses still coming in to the hiddenness, God's hiddenness, between Blake Junta and Justin Sheba. Just a quick one here from Jeff in Hillsborough, Ohio, though, who says, for those of us who are too lazy to go through the Unbelievable archive, there are a couple of ways to have Google do the work for you. Your listeners might like this information. Here are examples of what to put into Google. Site, premier.org.uk, Unbelievable Evolution. And then it'll come up with all the Unbelievable and Evolution sort of tagged shows from Unbelievable. Or put in site colon premierchristianradio.com and then Bart and then Ehrman. And you'll come up with all the Unbelievable shows featuring Bart Ehrman. You say, I didn't find any shows with R.C. Sproul. He has a unique take on apologetics and prophecy. And it would be interesting to hear how people respond to him. Thank you very much, Jeff, for getting in touch. I've been saving this one up for a little while. Margaret got in touch with me several weeks ago after we aired that really interesting discussion between Joe Ogborn and Tom Hallam, my friend, the atheist churchgoer. The atheist in question being Tom, who goes to church every week with his Christian friend Joe. Now, they had a great discussion, and Margaret's email, I thought, deserved a special place of its own. So here we go. Here's what Margaret had to say in response to that. Hi, Justin. It was about a decade ago that I daydreamed for a little while about what if there was a setup for Christians and non-Christians to get together regularly for civil and honest debate. I think it was around then that you started your show, though I've only discovered it in the last year. Thank you for this great work you do in allowing people to apply critical thinking to Christian beliefs. I really appreciate that you prod the Christian debaters as well as the skeptics to provide the best possible explanations for the position they hold. I greatly enjoyed the episode, my friend the atheist churchgoer. I'm a Christian, but I saw a lot of parallels with my journey and that of Tom the atheist. I have many doubts, lots of them still unresolved, and Tom asks a lot of questions that keep coming back to me and phrases them so well. For example, it's all very well for Christians to have pat answers to what it is that we're trusting God for, but it's another to actually live that and be able to feel it. Doubt is not incompatible with walking with God. It may surprise some Christians that God can actually cope with us having such thoughts and feelings, and if Tom had expressed all his doubts and then said he was a Christian, I for one would have believed him. In addition, in some very fundamental issues relating to basic promises about God being with us and giving us peace in this world of strife, I have had the experience of God not showing up for 25 years straight until a few tiny dribbles in the last few weeks. One can argue that he did show up sooner, I just haven't seen it, and that could be, but the fact remains, I haven't seen it. Would someone argue I was just blind and rebellious? Possibly, but really that's just an assumption. I saw a similar sort of assumption in some of the online comments to that episode about Tom, and I'm sad that some people have been so quick to blame him for the doubts he has. One time when I was telling our minister that I was failing at trusting God, his response was, looking at how you're going about your life, I think you do trust God. You just haven't had the confident feelings that you thought would go with it. Similar, really, at the emotional level to how intellectual doubts don't preclude a relationship with God. As I was listening to Tom describe his experience, I couldn't help wondering he may be closer to God than he thinks he is. I do hope and pray that it takes less than my 25 years for Tom to feel that God has shown up. Jeremiah 29:13 tells us that we will find God when we seek him with all our heart. And looking at how some people seem to have no doubts or questions at all, and thinking on the other end of the scale about Jacob wrestling with God, it really does seem to me that God asks for more persistence that way from some of us than others. And I don't know why. There has been no formula that has helped me with these issues, no predictable way that any person has been able to figure it out. The only thing that's really helped me with my doubts and disbelief is taking those things themselves directly to God and asking him about it, often just sitting there with those thoughts and feelings and prepared over the long haul to wait an indefinite time for him to help me sort them out. I so appreciate Tom being willing to put voice to what he's experiencing, and my feeling is that there won't be any formula for him either, but I am hopeful that God will help him figure things out. Ultimately, God is the only hope we've got. Blessings and thanks again for your show. Thank you, Margaret. And Margaret knows actually that my wife, who is a minister of a church, used that letter in a recent sermon on God in the desert place. But lovely to hear from you, Margaret, and all the very best with your journey. Tara gets in touch, says, as regards last week's show, Hindu guest and Christian guest. You are an exemplary host. I greatly appreciate you spreading your wings again. Feels like the good old days. There are so many stories humans tell regarding God, and some are better than others. In my opinion, any form of universalistic religion can be beneficial. I myself don't find the need to choose one particular concept. God creates only perfectly and loves unconditionally. There are, of course, universalistic Christians, and thankfully they're rapidly growing in number. I have faith that one day you will transition into that more moral and loving worldview. Meanwhile, please host more people of various faith traditions, maybe one a month. Tell you what, Justin, if you do that, I promise to donate to Premier. Buddhist, Zoroastrian, native spiritualist, Gnosticist, heaven forbid, bring on a nun that leads towards New Age woo, perhaps. For me, the stories humans create about God don't matter one whit. Love should always be one's foundation. Thank you very much, Tara. I couldn't possibly take donations in return for particular show topics, but I do hear your plea for more interfaith debates, and we'll see if we can produce a number more of those in the year. Can't promise one a month, but I certainly can promise more of them. Thomas says, thanks for putting on a great show on Krishna and Christ with Ken Samples and Deepan Rajaguru. I learned a lot from the dialogue, but unfortunately, Ken's approach reminded me how interfaith dialogue often ends up like comparing apples and oranges, unless those involved first examine the underlying values each person's worldview brings to the table. For example, Ken objected to Krishna on the grounds of sketchy historicity. But perhaps historicity concerning Hinduism's central story simply isn't a value that Hindus share. As Deepan expressed, Ken also objected that religious pluralism can't be maintained without throwing out the laws of logic. But in Hinduism, such an analytical propositional approach need not be prioritized if Atman is Brahman, if all is one. Ken also objected that Krishna did not do anything for the believer to change their status in the afterlife, as Jesus did. But this is clearly importing a Christian preoccupation with the afterlife that Hindus don't necessarily value, especially given their concepts of reincarnation and karma. So while I don't necessarily disagree with Ken on any of his objections, let's take this as a learning experience that interfaith dialogue, especially between Eastern and Western religions, has to start by laying out the underlying core values if it's going to be productive and charitable. We as Christians wouldn't want others objecting to our worldview by importing values that are foreign to Christianity. Let's not do it to our fellows of other religions and worldviews, says Thomas. Now, Naren has got in touch. And he is actually a Christian from India. Says, please excuse the long email. I'm a fairly recent fan of your podcast. Think it's the best of all of them out there. I can't but feel awed at your temperament in conducting the debates. I'm from the Sakshi Apologetics Network India. We engage in a significant number of apologetic seminars, workshops and debates, mostly in local languages. I heard the latest debate between Ken and Deepan. To be honest, I wasn't impressed with what was said and just repeated really pop understandings with no basis in reality or the original manuscripts. To summarise a few points, Rajaguru spoke about the so-called moral teachings in the Gita, but dropped out the verses where Krishna exhorts the Arjuna to not hesitate killing his cousins he's fighting against and kill them for the sake of karma. Jesus, on the other hand, speaks about turning the other cheek, give without expecting and giving the shirt also if the person asks for a cloak. Krishna also taught that lies which are spoken for a good cause are not bad. No wonder Yudhishthira, the oldest of the Pandavas, could kill his teacher with guile, all under the guise that this lie was for a good cause. Karma against pop understanding is not what goes around comes around as per Vedic principles. Karma is simply deeds, good deeds that you do. The good deeds are offering sacrifices on the likes of what we see in the Old Testament. Matter of fact, at the time of the Buddha, it's understood that in search of enlightenment, Buddha had come to Varanasi and saw rivers of blood flowing from these sacrifices. He outrightly rejected Hinduism since he saw it to be heartless. So the inclusion of Buddha as an avatar was a much later development. He mentioned that karma allows you to learn from your mistakes. My question to Rajaguru is to let us know whether even he is aware of what mistakes he has made in his past life. What is his karma balance? There is no such information made available in any manner to the person in question. Matter of fact, it absolves individuals to help other human beings in suffering, since I can simply walk away from a human in suffering by saying, oh, he's suffering the outcome of his karma. I shouldn't be interfering in the same, else he'll suffer again. And Rajaguru also mentioned that the caste system is based on the profession. Someone can change caste, and that casteism was implemented by the colonialists. Other than one isolated reference in the Veda Samhita, this goes against solid evidences from remaining Hindu scriptures and even history, even if one provides novel and hair-splitting interpretations of Hindu scriptures. For example, in Buddhist texts written before Christ, Buddha's conversation with the then Brahmins are recorded. It's very clear from those conversations at the time of Buddha that casteism was not merely a profession by lineage. Thank you very much, and you make a number of other critics criticisms that you felt should have been brought up in that programme. I hope, though, that in this right of reply section, you feel that that's been aired in some way. Naren, thanks for listening. Glad you discovered the show. Jonathan Mitchell, who's assistant professor of the Department of Mathematics and Statistics at Stephen F. Austin State University, says, you mentioned the Gandhi quote, "I like your Christ, but not your Christians." Even Deepin suggested Jesus was an enlightened person, along with Buddha and Muhammad. Many people are willing to swallow a more palatable Jesus as opposed to a radical, divine and sacrificial Jesus. C.S. Lewis's Lord Liar Lunatic argument seems relevant here. Why do Deepin and others include a fourth? Jesus could have been learned, alliteration at its finest. But I'm not sure why people suggest he was so great without the use of the New Testament. And the Jesus of the New Testament was not simply an enlightened one. On a separate matter, I've heard theologian Justin Holcomb on multiple occasions say that karma is cruel. The more I think about it, the more I agree. Karma says, if you're poor, then tough. You deserve to be poor because of the sins in your past life. No hope. When bad stuff happens, and look around, it happens a lot, it's your own fault. I found myself shaking my head in sorrow and pity to hear Deepin explain matter-of-factly that there is no hope for those who fail to live a good life. Deepin suggested the Ten Commandments were good rules to follow. I know for a fact that I've broken all of them, even the one that no one except God can see. Don't covet. And I'm not even aware of every time I've broken them. If I'm to atone for my own mistakes, then I'm truly hopeless. Who will deliver me from this body of death? Thanks be to God through Christ Jesus our Lord, my only hope. All right, thank you very much. We've also got some more responses to the Divine Hiddenness show. Just really a few minutes to maybe read out one or two of these. Apologies, we'll try and get more of them in a future edition of the programme. But Carrie on Facebook got in touch to say, love the show, thanks for doing what you do so well. I was frustrated, though, with the podcast from Blake Junter. Some ways his general way of communicating with all of his premises that seemed quite stretched out, but mainly as a Christian, I found myself quickly debating where I felt he fell short in argument. I was wondering if you felt the same way. I was wondering if there was a reason no scripture was brought into the debate and why it was from this, well, perhaps perspective. Do guests have rules they agree to before the debate? If so, are these rules available to listeners somewhere? I thought it would be fun to write my comments on the episode, and if so, I'd like to share it. And I was wondering if other listeners have done that before and have an opportunity to do it in some way. Well, Carrie, the best place to do that is, of course, if you want to comment directly on the episode, you can do that underneath the show on the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Just look for the debate on divine hiddenness. There aren't any rules I give my guests in advance for the programme, but this was, in a sense, a very philosophical programme, which I said a number of times, not one where we're necessarily going to be bringing in a lot of scriptural verses. It's presented in a way that is inevitably a bit different, perhaps, to other ways of presenting on the issue. Paul, on the issue of hiddenness of God, says, I would have approached it in a different way to Blake. It seems to me that given the fact we're rational, responsible, relational beings, that proves the existence of a God who has those qualities, i.e. the triune God of the Bible. Rather than God being hidden, we're exposed to the proof of his existence at every waking moment, in every conscious thought and free action. Furthermore, we encounter the reality of objective morality every day. We're aware of our own failure and moral shortcomings. However, the fact of our objective morality points to the fact of a righteous God. It cannot be grounded any other way. So if someone is aware of their guilt, in what way is God hidden? If, however, one refuses to acknowledge the reality of the guilt, then how could they ever have a relationship with a righteous God? They are the one hiding from God, rather than God hiding from them. And we'll share some more of those next week. Thank you. It really sparked a really interesting debate, that Divine Hiddenness show of a few weeks ago now, Justin Sheba and Blake Junter. If you want to find that, plus any of the other programmes that have been mentioned in the feedback today, do go to the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Details there, of course, of Unbelievable, the conference 2017. Not too late if you're listening before the end of Monday, the 13th of March, to get the early bird ticket. But if you're listening later, no worries. It's really not that expensive to come along to the conference. And there are, of course, group discounts. You'll get last year's conference on DVD for free if you book two or more tickets. So why not get along to this year's conference? Look forward to seeing lots of unbelievable listeners there. premier.org.uk/whychrist. Coming up next week, you're unbelievable. Theo Hobson and Andrew Copson in debate over whether God created humanism. Theo Hobson's new book is called God Created Humanism, and Andrew Copson is the head of the British Humanist Association. That should be an interesting discussion, shouldn't it? Hope you can be there for it too. Until next week, see you then.